Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Gates, how Erdc makes the difference. I'm Annette Kirkland and I want to welcome you to Season 2, Episode 13. And we are going to be chasing planes and trains. I have with me today Jeremy Beasley. He is the GEO Information Specialist. And Jeb Tingle. He is the Senior Research Civil Engineer and Program Manager with the Geotechnical and Structures Laboratory. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Y'all did that in unison. That was great. And I'm always so happy to have a couple of people with me because we're going to have some great conversation this morning. So the first question, what are your roles at Erdc? And I guess y'all can pick straws on who goes first.
Well, I'll go ahead and go first. This is Jeb Tingle. I'm a senior scientific technical manager at Erdc, and I've spent about 31 years there, including my time as a summer intern. And so it's been an enjoyable trip. And currently, though, as a senior scientific technical manager, my role is to lead large programs, research programs, to work with customers and stakeholders to try to understand what their problems are, then come back to Erdc, talk to the program different managers and technical scientists to understand who has availability and the right skill set to attack that problem, and then build a team of different disciplinary research scientists and engineers to develop new products and tools for that customer to use to solve their problem. So really, I think of it as more as a business development role.
Okay.
Right now is kind of the role I'm in. And then secondly, once we're doing the project, once we're conducting the research, then I provide some technical oversight to make sure that the technical product that we're delivering to the customer meets their need, but is also technically sound and fundamentally sound.
Fantastic. Jeremy?
This is Jeremy Beasley. I am a geo information specialist. I currently lead the Erdc Railroad Track Evaluation Program. We go out and do visual and ultrasonic surveys for the Army and the Air Force, and we have some other special customers such as NASA and customers like that that kind of have a unique non-traditional railroad type evaluation. In addition to that, we're currently trying to build our railroad evaluation research. A lot of the gaps that we identify in the field, we try to turn those into proposals and leads to new funding. We partner with our industry, academia, and our military to try to find where we can have synergy with those different groups and provide an overall product for the nation.
Fantastic. Well, as we'll progress into this conversation today, the listeners will find out more and more how you guys make the difference. So thank you for what you do. So here we go. Tell me about yourselves and your background, and what steps did you take to get to where you are, and what is your relationship with the community?
Well, my background, I'm from Vicksburg. I went to Warren Central for a couple of years, and then I transitioned over to Vicksburg High School. I graduated in 1991.
So, Viking and a Gator?
The class of 91 is kind of unique because that was when we redrew the district lines, and many of the students in that era that were going to or traditionally going to Warren Central or traditionally going to Vicksburg had to switch schools.
Right.
And so that class is very unique in that we hold joint class reunions because many of us are friends across, and some of us had to move and some of us had to stay. And so that class is very a close-knit class, and it has its own Facebook page and has gatherings, not just during the reunions, but they'll have dinners and get-togethers all throughout the year. If you're tracking the Facebook page and you're paying attention, then you can take that opportunity to connect with your classmates over and over again. But being from Vicksburg, it really is a close-knit community. And then working at Erdc has allowed me to continue to be an advocate of Vicksburg throughout the years because of the great opportunities that it provides to the community and to the citizens of the area for career and others.
Okay. So, Jeremy?
So I'm born and raised in Vicksburg, graduated from St. Aloysius High School in 2000. Went to Mississippi State and graduated there in 2005, and actually Jeb hired me as a contractor.
This guy right here?
Yeah, this guy. I don't know how it happened, but anyway, Jeb hired me back around 2006 or 7 as a contract technician, and one way or another, I've been at Erdc since that time. I left for a little while and came back, but My thing that I remember is that my grandfather worked out at Erdick.
Okay.
He retired from the Navy and ended up out there, and I believe at the time it was called ISD, but basically the mobility branch where they were testing different vehicles, tanks, helicopters, and he even worked on some of the lunar testing that happened back at West.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I don't really remember growing up at St. Al anyway is that we didn't really have any engineers or scientists come in and talk to us about what was going on at Erdick.
Right.
And even though that my grandfather worked there, I knew that they had all these cool military vehicles, they had the river model out there, I clearly remember that, but I never knew that the opportunities that were there at Erdick until Jeb hired us, a lot of three or four of us there graduated from Mississippi State.
Okay.
And we traveled for, I don't know, 2 years.
2 years, years straight.
Basically, testing how to drop a cargo airplane on unsurfaced runways, doing a little mud riding in a C-17.
Yeah.
Oh, really? That's all you were doing?
Yeah.
It was kind of a scary and exciting project at the time, but there was so much travel involved that it just made sense to hire a lot of young people that were
right.
very energetic, and they didn't have young families really yet that would prevent them from traveling and staying gone from home a lot. And
right.
so we had a lot of talent come in right about that time, and we hired one, and he connected us to others, and Jeremy was in that group of four or five guys that have all become long-term Erdick employees now, and very productive team, and it was a good fit for the project, but the project was just one of those that was a little different because it was traveling around the country. But it was also exciting because you were landing this very large 580,000-pound airplane on a dirt runway. And and it was a little bit scary because we were developing new guidance for that. So it was kind of unknown up to that point of what that plane could and could not do. So we're trying to push the envelope to determine under what conditions it could operate, and including wet conditions. And that was one of the scariest things. We would go out and wet this dirt runway, essentially make it very slippery, and then see how far the plane took to land. So how far it slid. So it would lock its brakes as it was landing, and it would just be sliding across this muddy
runway.
So
were y'all in the airplane when it was sliding?
No, we were on the ground. We were on the ground taking measurements. And,
okay, good. That was going to be a little scary story too, so.
Yeah, in fact, Jeremy kind of showed some of his technical prowess early on. He came in and he started running one of our sophisticated friction measurement devices, and he became one of the go-to guys on that project to get out there right before the airplane landed. He would go out and he would run a friction test, which was driving this vehicle and pulling this little friction device behind it, mm-hmm. which would then lock its wheel every once in a while and measure the surface friction. And so based upon that measurement, we would call into the aircraft and tell them whether it was safe to land or not. And so we were trying to fall within a certain range of friction so that we could generate the data that we needed. And so Jeremy was out there collecting. He would call me on the radio and he'd say, hey, it's really wet. we need to circle them a few more times to let it dry out a little bit. Or it's right in the zone that we were looking for, and it was good to go. So
okay.
we kind of worked together early on. He'd only been there like 6 months at that time. And he was already a key member of our team working on a very important project for the military, because the C-17 Globemaster is the main strategic aircraft for the Air Force, and it delivers all of our air payload typically around the world. So it can go on paved airfields, of course, and it's the one that we go overseas, you know, transports equipment and supplies from here mm-hmm. directly into the war zone, or it can go directly onto an unpaved surface like that. And actually, it was the first aircraft to land in Afghanistan. When we didn't have an airfield, if you don't know, Afghanistan is landlocked and it's mountainous terrain all around it, so it's hard to get in there. And so one of the ways that they came in is they found a dry lake bed, similar to what we were testing on.
Right.
And they landed the aircraft, according to our criteria, on this dry lake bed with a group of Marines that then seized one of the permitted airfields so that they could bring more aircraft in. So they brought in a group of C-17s, deployed the Marines. The Marine force then went in and seized one of the Bagram or Kandahar airfield, and then opened that airfield up to the U.S. to move more supplies and materials in. So, and all that came from the work that we did here at Erdick.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was really cool for me personally to come full circle, because my uncle was a co-pilot on the C-17. And so when I was a teenager, I got to go to Charleston Air Force Base and walk inside of a C-17. And I was like, man, it's so big you could play football in here. And to be able to see that aircraft, doing that testing that we were doing that was state-of-the-art, nobody mm-hmm. had ever done it, was pretty special to me.
Right.
And, we talked about chasing the airplane. Well, I'd go out in front, the airplane was chasing me.
So we really did mean chasing planes and trains. I love that.
Exactly.
Well, is there any other part of this growth in your relationship that's kind of made the story that we're going to tell today? Anything else that you want to?
Well, we're working now. We haven't really worked together since, directly since 2007, 2008, around mm-hmm. that time. But Jeb, like he mentioned, he's going out and getting new business, and he's well aware of the issues that we face in the railroad program and some of the ideas that we have on the research that we want to do. Mm-hmm. So he's able to go out and leverage some of his contacts to gain new research areas and funding.
Right.
And so we have a recent railroad project where we're looking at trying to automate some of our current inspection practices, mm-hmm. where we can speed the process up, gain the same amount of information that we're currently doing with sensors mm-hmm. And keep some of our guys from having to travel so much. Because right now we currently walk every single track and we kick every single bolt. So that can be that can be a track system a tenth of a mile long all the way up to some of our track systems that are 250 miles. So that can greatly...
They get their steps in other words. Okay.
Yeah, we get plenty of steps in.
Okay,
daily.
Good.
And some of the things we've done, like we recently acquired through one of our programs a new heavy vehicle simulator. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, working with Jeremy's team, we developed the specifications and requirements that would allow us in order to not only test the aircraft, the largest aircraft that we have in inventory, the C-5, the B-52, the C-17, mm-hmm. and then fighter aircraft, but it also has the capability now to test rail bogies, because one of the things that we have not been able to do is to simulate railroad cars, because their loading on railroad cars is extremely heavy.
Right.
And so we added that capability to this new machine. It was delivered last year, so we took possession of it, and we're going to begin doing our first research project on the structural capacity of rail systems coming up this summer. And that was a cooperation between Jeremy's team and ours, where we sat down. We looked at what kind of loading the rail cars have, what kind of issues we have, and then we kind of use that to develop the specifications to make sure that the equipment that the state-of-the-art equipment that we're acquiring for research was not only suitable for ground vehicles and aircraft, but it was also suitable for evaluating rail.
Right.
And so that's been a good cooperative effort. And we're going to work with his team to kind of finalize details on what that research experiment looks like in terms of the details, what kind of track structure we want to test that would help us to solve some problems that we're seeing across the Army's rail infrastructure.
Okay.
Yeah, we currently get a lot of questions on, hey, just make it generic, but we've got installation ABC, and they want to come down track one with 100 tanks. And we get a question on, hey, can my track sustain this? And frankly, we don't have a good way to give that answer right now, because a lot of the tracks were built back in the 40s and 50s,
right.
And so there's as-built drawings, they don't exist, so we have to go out there and actually do physical surveys of the track, and that's where we're trying to use some of these sensors, such as ground-penetrating radar, to identify areas of concern ahead of time, so we can address those before they become extremely severe, right?
Right.
Because if they're catastrophic defects, we can't operate them across that area. When we do an inspection, we're going out and identifying areas of maintenance. We identify areas that can restrict speed, and then we're identifying areas where the track, we don't allow trains to go across that area. So when we go out and identify a defect and say that track is closed to traffic, that's a major impact on readiness.
Right.
So if we can identify those conditions before they become more severe, we can basically improve the sustainment of those systems.
Yeah, and you can see the impact of that now, but if you're just watching the news and the derailments that have happened in Ohio,
right,
and the severity of those derailments now, the primary one was a chemical car overturn, but we have a lot of, I guess, precious cargo on our
right.
military bases that we don't want So if you have a derailment, that's a major issue. So that's why we have to close the track if we see something that's concerning. And as Jeremy mentioned, the ability to forecast that and allow you to conduct maintenance or track improvements to keep the track open and ready and able to support the mission is really critical to the military.
So important, so important. Okay, so if you're just tuning in, we are having a great conversation about chasing planes and trains with Jeremy Beasley and Jeb Tingle, and this is Beyond the Gates. So I understand that your branch has done some really incredible work over the years. Can you tell us about the history of the ERTIC Airfield and Pavements Branch, or otherwise known as APB?
Yeah, so originally, Waterways Experiment Station was founded after the flood of the Mississippi River in 1927, and the government decided that they needed to consolidate a lot of its research capability into one place to better understand flooding and how to protect against flooding. And so they established the Waterways Experiment Station in Vicksburg around 1928-29, and then from that, they brought in a lot of talent, a lot of engineers and scientists who specialized in geotechnical engineering, soils, identification, and the development of earth and structures. Not too long after that, as you know, we entered World War II, and World War II was the rapid development of aircraft. So aircraft had existed since the early 1900s, but they were relatively in their infancy, but the onslaught of the war made the development of larger planes, bombers, and the evolution of those happen much, much more quickly as a lot of the American resources was put into fighting World War II. And so the evolution of aircraft during that period was probably as great as it ever was. And so aircraft that were able to used to land on grass fields and without much problem that were pretty lightweight evolved into the very heavy bomber systems that would rut up the grass fields. And the government quickly understood that, hey, we need to build a pavement. We need something to support these aircraft. If we're going to be able to fight this war and support this mission, then we're going to have to pull together. We're going to have to be more intentional about how we design our airfields. Can't just be a grass meadow somewhere anymore, right? Because the planes have gotten too big and too heavy. And so they said, where do we have this conglomeration of experts at? And it was in Vicksburg, Mississippi. They had all these geotechnical engineers that were soil scientists and understand foundations. And so they started a branch here at the Waterways Experiment Station that has evolved into the Airfields and Pavements Branch. So there, it was Pavement Systems Division for a while, and then it became the Airfields and Pavements Branch. And I think we're on the cusp of evolving into what I would call the Transportation Infrastructure Branch, because
Is that an unofficial official name?
It's an unofficial official. As you know, we're a little bit slow to move on our organizational chart sometimes. We want to hold on to that history.
Right.
But I think that to be more appropriate, because we do a lot of different things. We do rail research, and we want to make sure that we capture that. That's a big part of our program now. Mm-hmm. And so we want to make sure we do that. But that history started all the way back in the 40s and then evolved, and then we had another large period of development in the 1960s around the Vietnam War, as the need to be able to rapidly build airfields in the theater of operations, mm-hmm. Spurned a lot of research and development activities. And then in the 1980s, as commercial aircraft evolved and got bigger and heavier, and commercial flight became more and more common, like up until the 60s, there wasn't a lot of people that just jumped on a DC-3 and went flying around the country. It was really for the elite, if you will. And now right. It's pretty common for people to take a flight from Mississippi to California or across the world. And it's a little bit more affordable because it is so commonplace. And as that evolution was happening, the planes just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so one of the term chasing planes means we're constantly trying to understand what these larger and heavier aircraft are doing to the pavements and build infrastructure to support them. Typically, the way that happens is that the new plane is designed and tested and built, and then they think about the pavement that has to support it. So it's a little bit backwards in our mind, is that like it should be co-developed, but typically we'll get a new aircraft like the C-17, mm-hmm. and then they'll say, okay, what can it do? Versus trying to, they have some design parameters early on, but you have to go out there and you have to do research and development to say how thick do we need to build the pavements, how strong do those pavements need to be, what kind of surface materials are compatible with those systems. And so the chasing planes is we're constantly chasing that next aircraft. And currently it's changing from those big, heavy C-17, Boeing 777, which is a commercial aircraft that's out there now. Mm-hmm. And it's evolving into, we have some innovative aircraft, our vertical takeoff and landing aircraft like the F-35, fifth generation fighter that's able to take off and land vertically, creates a different set of challenges from the pavement engineer's perspective because it's put us a lot of heat on the pavement. So now we need heat-resistant surface materials that are able to withstand those jet engines while they're landing vertically on those vertical takeoff and landing pads. And so the design of that has been evolving. And so that's kind of the history of airfields and pavements. It started essentially with World War II, mm-hmm. and it's been evolving ever since. And we support, we are the tri-service lead. That means that we're the lead for the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines. We are the lead research agency for everything in the airfield pavement realm. And so they did that because we had the largest concentration of engineers with this specialty and trying to consolidate and reduce redundancy across the government in terms of the research capability. That most of the government's research capability resides here in Vicksburg, Mississippi.
In other words, Vicksburg has it going on.
Engineer City, I believe.
Yeah, I pretty much think that's what we are. That's right. So what are some important procedures in airfield evaluation?
So in an airfield evaluation, some of the common technologies, there are two critical things that we need to understand about the pavement. One is the strength of the materials, and the second is the thickness of those materials. And typically pavements are developed in layers that progress from the natural ground as being the weakest layer. Then you'll have an intermediate layer that has a little bit stronger capability and will distribute the load. And then the surface is normally a very high quality material that resists the tire pressure from whether it's a truck or an aircraft. It'll resist that tire pressure a little bit. And then it'll spread the load out to a small enough load that the natural ground can support it so you don't have rutting or cracking in the pavement. Mm-hmm. And so in evaluation, we're trying to understand how strong that pavement is and what the layer structure is in terms of thicknesses. And we use those things to determine whether that pavement's suitable for a particular ground vehicle or aircraft. And so we do that in a number of ways. We have a number of different tools that we use. Ground penetrating radar helps us determine the thickness of those layers, what layers are there, what thicknesses they are. We use soil strength penetrometer devices that allow us to measure soil strength and layering. And we use a heavyweight deflectometer for airfields in particular that drops a weight on the pavement that simulates an aircraft load or wheel load. And we measure the deflection as it moves out away from the load. So that deflection pattern tells us how stiff that pavement is and mm-hmm. allows us to determine the relative strength of that foundation. And then we have a procedure that we've developed here at ERDC that allows us to assess whether that's suitable for a particular aircraft. And so that entire structural evaluation of an airfield pavement or a road pavement is used across the world. It's used by the International Civil Aviation Organization. And it's changing. Right now there's a new procedure that's very similar. It's just a tweak in that procedure to mm-hmm. modernize it a little bit, because that procedure was developed in the 1980s and we've been using it pretty consistently ever since. And it's being tweaked right now to adjust for some modern technology that's evolving. And so it's gonna change a little bit, but we're at the forefront of that. We're helping develop that criteria, not only for the world, but we're doing in particular our mission is for the military. Right. And so we have to understand the impact that those aircraft have. We have to protect those assets by building infrastructure to support them. As Jeremy mentioned earlier, mission readiness is our number one priority. We have to be able to support the military's mission. And so if those airfields are not sufficient to support next generation aircraft, then we're not going to be able to support that mission.
We'll be in trouble.
Yeah, we will.
Absolutely. I'm Annette Kirkland. Beyond the Gates continues in a moment. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
This is Alderman Alex Monsoor, City of Vicksburg. Spring is in the air, and our festivals are happening now. Our merchants and our restaurants are in full swing. and they invite you to shop and dine and see all of our improvements to our waterfront and our downtown area. On behalf of the Mayor and Board of Aldermen, we want to thank our merchants and our restaurants, and most of all, we want to thank our citizens for making Vicksburg a great place to live, work, and play.
Welcome back to Beyond the Gates. You're listening to News Talk 107.7. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Beyond the Gates. I'm Annette Kirkland, and we are speaking with Jeremy Beasley and Jeb Tingle. They are with the Geotechnical and Structures Laboratory, otherwise known as GSL, and we're chasing planes and trains. Airfields are some of the military's most vital assets, and any damage to them can slow down operations. What do you and your colleagues do to help prevent the damage, and what do you do when it comes to making repairs? And I think you've already touched on that a little bit, haven't you?
Well, yeah, but it's not just airfields. It's airfields, roads, and rail are the main ways that we transport supplies and materials from point A to point B. So whether it's what we call power projection, which is taking those supplies and materials from the United States to the point of need, whether it be in the Pacific region or whether it be in the European region or whether it be in Southwest Asia, we have to have very effective, what we call power projection platforms, which are essentially our airfields, our ports, and our rail infrastructure. How do we to move our supplies and materials from the peacetime bases to the point of need? Mm-hmm. And so that's the primary role that we play. A lot of times as we get closer to the area of action, which we call the theater of operations, it's the theater, the local area where there's the military is actually supporting, there's conflict, then you'll see that sometimes those areas get damaged. And so one of the major programs we've had in the past, over about the past 15 years, is airfield damage repair. Mm-hmm. And we've been studying ways to rapidly repair bomb craters and runways. So as the adversary would come in, one of the first things that an adversary will do, and in fact what we do in any conflict, is to try to seize control of the air. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what's happening in the Ukraine right now, is they're trying to fight for superior air superiority. Is a big deal. If you control the skies, then you can control a lot of what happens on the ground. Mm-hmm. So what we try to do in our situation is, if an adversary would bomb or attack our airfields, that's going to be one of the first things that happens in any major conflict, then we need to rapidly be able to restore flight operations at that facility. So we have a lot of investment in our aircraft, and we need to be able to either get them off the ground, launch them, and then we need to be able to bring them back down, refuel them, rearm them, and get them back in the fight in order to be effective. So we have to be able to go out and repair bomb craters and runways, and typically that timeline is very fast, because in order to be relevant, you don't have days or weeks.
You need Superman.
So we had embarked upon an early program that had to repair 120 small craters in about 8 hours.
Wow.
So that was a difficult challenge. We spent several years developing rapid setting concrete technology, expandable foam technology, new mat systems to provide temporary surfaces. We developed all these into kits, and the Air Force, Army, and Navy and Marines have all fielded those kits now. So it's one of the largest programs where we demonstrated the ERDC philosophy of discover, develop, and deliver, where we discovered new materials. We developed them into practical solutions, provided kits, and we delivered those kits into the hands of the warfighter, mm-hmm. including training materials. So we teach them how to employ those kits, how to conduct the repairs, how to maintain the repairs over time to continue to support their mission. So that program by itself was about a $2 billion program.
With a B now, everyone.
$2 billion with a B, yes.
Yes, sir. That's
and
right.
Our part wasn't $2 billion. The research did not cost that much, but the fielding of all those kits and the training of all those kits and deployment of them around the world is a big deal. And we see, it's kind of enjoyable to see on, we've seen on Fox News and CBS News, we're watching the news about something that was happening in Syria and an airfield had been damaged, and we see our solution that was developed here in Vicksburg, Mississippi, being used on the news by warfighters, mm-hmm. to rapidly repair that airfield, to restore it up to flight operations, so that we could be able to conduct missions there to fight ISIS. And it was one of those moments, those aha moments, because as a researcher, sometimes you don't get to see the benefits of your research. Like, you know you're right. Doing something good, but you don't get to see the reality of it. And the reality was, that we are supporting real people out there. We're enabling them to do their job and to support their mission. And that mission is to support America's fight on terrorism and freedom. And so that was an extremely rewarding event. Similarly, I'm going to transition over to Jeremy and let him talk a little about, but we're going down that road. So a lot of with rail repair. So we have several initiatives now to understand that one of the things that's going to happen in any wartime event, particularly in the European theater, would be to deny our rail assets. Because one of the key ways that we move supplies and materials around in Europe is through rail. Mm-hmm. And so one of the key features there would be to deny rail. And you see that also in playing out in the Ukrainian war, is that the Russians and the Ukrainians are denying rail operations to each other so that they can't resupply.
Right.
So we need ability to go out there and rapidly repair our rail infrastructure as well. And I'll let Jeremy tell you a little bit about the initiative we have coming up in that.
Right. So, Jeb, as Jeb mentioned, there are a lot of studies and research that's been done on a lot of subgrade and substructure. And whether it's pavements or rail, it's kind of the same thing on evaluating that piece. Now, when we get up to the top of the surface and we're evaluating pavements versus the track superstructure, which includes the ballast, the cross ties, the rail itself, all of that, it's a little bit different in how we model the degradation of that track system as it ages. So what we're trying to do is not reinvent the wheel. We're trying to learn from Jeb and some of the other researchers that have already solved a lot of these problems. I mean, we kind of joke around that they've been learning how to fill in a hole for about 30 years now. Right? So there's different ways, different techniques, and we're concentrated mostly on a contingency operation where we want to get the train across one time where they're, you know, the soldiers and the train's not sitting there out in the open where they're an easy target.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can find a way to go in and rapidly make a repair via kit that we can, you know, deploy out of the back of an airplane or that we contain on the train itself,
mm-hmm.
that's what we're kind of looking, trying to do, is that given the training to the soldiers to be able to use the kit properly and get that train across and limit, you know, the hours that we're sitting there as a free target.
It's pretty complex because you've got to go in there and cut this big heavy rail out that's been up or damaged from an explosive device, and you've got to come in there, you got to reestablish that ballast, you know, and level it back out,
right.
and provide a solid foundation. You got to put ties back in there, and then you've got to somehow attach new rail to that damaged rail that you've cut out and either weld it or connect it up mechanically so that the trains can traverse it. So, and as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people don't understand, but the train loadings are actually heavier than most aircraft loadings. And so it's a little bit different scale of a problem.
Right.
Is that those are very, very heavy loads that you're trying to bring across something that's a temporary repair. And so we're just getting started in it. And as Jeremy said, we're going to try to leverage lessons learned on certain aspects. But there's a lot of part of the rail repair that is significantly different from especially the superstructure perspective. And we're going to have to learn some things. We're going to have to utilize some modern technology. We're looking at new materials, new construction capability and technologies mm-hmm. that are out there, such as friction stir welding and things. And how do we take advantage of those and provide the most effective and efficient solution? Because in a military scenario, we don't have all the luxuries that you might have in a peacetime scenario. We
right.
have to be able to deploy. It has to be lightweight. It can't be super heavy because we're going to try to get it to a remote location. Because they're typically not going to blow up our rail right there where it's convenient to repair. It's going to be in a remote spot. So we're going to have to get the kit there. We're going to have to be able to then have it done fast because our assets are sitting there when they can't move. And agility is very important. If it's a stationary thing, we call mm-hmm. that a target. So
right.
So if they've limited our ability to move that asset around, then it's really providing an ease of functionality for the enemy to kind of target those assets and remove them from the war or the conflict.
Yeah, I mean, rail is a great operational tool to move a lot of equipment. But mm-hmm. one thing that people, you know, especially me, I didn't understand. The only thing I knew about a railroad track before I started was that I drove everyone to work, right?
Yeah.
But
right.
I mean, it's an expensive asset to maintain.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of metal, a lot of rock, a lot of wood. And one of the things that we're trying to do as well is try to identify new alternatives to wood preservation.
Mm-hmm.
So cross ties are currently treated with creosote. At some point down the road, there could come a time where people don't see that as a viable solution for treating wood. So we're working with Mississippi State University on trying to identify some new ways for sustaining that wood product so we can not only reduce the amount of maintenance, but extend the life of the track on military installations.
I can only imagine as a person repairing, you know, and on spot, how important their job is. I just can't imagine going, okay, it's all on you. You got to make this perfect for this train to go. That just seems so stressful.
And currently, it is. And currently in the military, especially the Army, there's not an organic repair capability for rail.
Right.
So a combination of our project that we mentioned with Jeb, looking at rail repair capabilities and kit, we're going to combine that with this training with the soldiers and then hopefully build that capability within the Army to go out and make these repairs.
Okay. So there is recent news surrounding the accidents on our nation's railroads. How are railroads evaluated, and what are some causes of failure?
Yeah, so Jeb touched on some of the commercial accidents that are happening right now, but for ERDC, we concentrate on strictly on DOD on track. Mm-hmm. So the tracks that you've seen the derailments on, that's commercial rail. They are monitored and have oversight from the Federal Railroad Administration. They're responsible for making sure that inspections are done on those tracks. As far as we're concerned, we go, and as I mentioned earlier, the Army, Air Force, and NASA tracks, we are on a 4 to 5 year rotation where we go out and do visual and ultrasonic internal flaw inspections. The visual inspections, we walk every track and kick every bolt, so we're looking for defect-free according to DOD standards.
Right.
The ultrasonic internal flaw allows us to see inside the rail itself, the metal. That we can't see with our human eye.
Right.
So it's shooting sound waves into the rail. We're looking for air voids. And the ultrasonic technology has different angles that it shoots the sound waves into the rail, and those angles are made to see certain defects. Mm-hmm. And so what we do is the truck rides down the rail, we run the test, we have an inspector in the truck, he identifies a deficiency on the screen, they stop the truck, and we do our QAQC right there in the field. We get out and do a hand test with an oscilloscope. And so the guys are actually able to measure the length of the defect, where the defect occurs, and based on their experience, they can tell us what that defect is and what the resulting speed restriction, maintenance restriction, or close to traffic restriction is based on that defect. Mm-hmm. All those defects are combined into an asset management system. We provide track structure condition indices. We provide maintenance and repair. So basic, if you've got a bad cross tie, the recommended maintenance is to replace the cross tie.
Right.
Some of them are simple. Some of them are more difficult. You know, if you've got a subgrade issue, you've got to go in and excavate the track down to the subgrade, re-put the ballast, re-put the cross ties, relay it all out.
That's so probably the worst scenario, right?
That's the worst scenario,
okay.
Right. And so that's why we're trying to add these new sensors in so we can identify those areas of concern that are minor now before they become catastrophic.
Absolutely. So what are some elements of railroad research and how is it tracked? Get it tracked?
Huh? Yeah.
I thought y'all would like that.
Yeah,
little,
sure.
You know.
So some of the initiatives that we're working on right now, like I mentioned, research from Mississippi State University on wood cross tie preservation. We've worked with Marshall University on automating the post-processing of GPR data. Anyone that's worked with GPR, it usually takes somebody highly skilled to do that type of analysis, and still it's a bunch of squiggly lines, and it has a little bit of judgment in there. So we use it strictly for identifying areas of concern, not mm-hmm. saying that there's an issue.
And a reminder, GPR is a ground penetrating radar, so we're using radar to see through the soil system to see what's underneath it and what condition it's in.
In addition, we've got some projects where we're looking at inspecting rail cars as they come onto an installation. Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of installations that have inspection pits, and currently they have 4 soldiers standing there, and they're basically doing recon of the locomotive and the cars as it comes onto the station. Mm-hmm. So they're looking for maintenance issues, they're looking for sabotage, any of those type things. So we currently have a project where we're looking to automate that down to either one soldier there that's looking at a screen mm-hmm. and visually identify it, or use an AI to eventually train the system to automatically, as the train comes in, there's a trigger that says the train's coming across this area. We scan the train for any kind of sabotage or maintenance, and that's reported back to the installation. So they can deny, or if there's, react security-wise if that's needed.
Right.
Hopefully not, right? But if in the event that's needed, we're hoping that our system will allow quick response to any kind of sabotage.
Okay.
Another project that we're doing that is we're working that's relevant to Vicksburg is working with Applied Research Associates, who have an office here in Vicksburg, and some of their modeling and computer science capability here in town is being applied to that in conjunction with the University of Illinois to help us to look at some of those automated inspection sensor technologies, as well as to develop, working with us to develop a new structural analysis tools to help us better predict how strong or how stiff that foundation of the rail infrastructure is. Right now, that doesn't even exist in commercial. So this is groundbreaking type research. This is, if successful, this will change the way that not only the DOD or Department of Defense looks at rail infrastructure in terms of being able to assess its structural capacity, but that would change the way that the Federal Rail Association and the commercial industry would look at it potentially. So there's a lot of potential impact from the work that's being funded through the government and being funded through the U.S. Army Engineer Research and Development Center and through our offices that we're providing input. So we're guiding that research. We're kind of near capacity. There's a lot of interest in rail right now, and we're kind of near the capacity of what we can do in-house. And our traditional work is to do our research in-house with some external support partnerships with academia and industry. And this is an excellent example of how we're partnering with academia and industry in the same project to try to accomplish a very difficult challenge. This is a complex challenge. There's a lot of pieces to it. External agencies that have solved one small part of it, or they have a piece of it, but no one has this complete process or structure for total analysis of the rail infrastructure. And so we're trying to lead in that area. So we're trying to move into a position where we're leading the research and development into becoming world-class research organization in the rail infrastructure. We've kind of been leading in the airfield for a while, but we're trying to beef up and to expand our influence in the rail infrastructure. And these projects are allowing that. There's a lot of funding coming into that right now. There's a lot of interest in it. There's recognition that this is a shortfall. This is a gap in the understanding right now that needs to be addressed. And so through these partnerships with Marshall, with Mississippi State, with the University of Illinois, with Applied Research Associates and others, and other agencies, we're also partnering with Federal Rail Association and others to try to understand what they're doing so that we can complement it and not try to redo the same type of work, but to add value to each other's work.
Yeah, just last week at Fort Campbell, we had about 12 visitors from ARA and the University of Illinois and a couple of different vendors that came out and did some demoing of the new sensor technologies using optical sensors, ground penetrating radar, other line sensors for automated detection of geometry defects. So that's one of the main things that causes us a lot of time and effort and out on the track. Obviously, walking track, 200 miles at a time can take some time to do. But if you've got to stop every 500 feet and take a measurement, or if you've got to get into a curve and take a certain measurement, that can, lengthen the time that you're out there. So if we can find a way to automate those measurements and get it in, incorporate it to our existing system, that's a win-win for us.
Absolutely. Well, if you're just tuning in, I am Annette Kirkland, and this is Beyond the Gates, and we're really finding out how ERTC makes the difference today. And we're talking about chasing planes and trains. I'm with Jeremy Beasley. He is the GEO Information Specialist. And Jeb Tingle, he is the Senior Research Civil Engineer and Program Manager with the Geotechnical and Structures Laboratory, otherwise known as GSL. Okay, so ERTC has unique, as we've been talking about, world-class equipment and facilities, ranging from the world's fastest supercomputers to one-of-a-kind physical models. Can you tell me about some of ERTC's unique testing facilities when it comes to the work that you do, HVS, test track, stuff like that? And I know we've already hinted on that a little bit, too. So,
well, I'll start with the HVS, which is the heavy vehicle simulator. So we obtained our first heavy vehicle simulator around 1998, and at that time it was the world's largest heavy vehicle simulator. It allowed us to simulate truck traffic as well as all the different aircraft traffic that were available at the time. Not long after that, the Federal Aviation Administration developed one that was a little bit bigger and had a unique capability more geared toward commercial aircraft. And so recently, last year, as I mentioned earlier, we obtained a new heavy vehicle simulator called the HVST, T for transportation, but we nicknamed it the Titan because it is the world's largest HVS heavy vehicle simulator. So we have At Erdc, we have the first and the third largest heavy vehicle simulators in the world. So two very unique, powerful capability that we use practically every day. Both systems are running on experiments.
In Vicksburg, Mississippi.
In Vicksburg, Mississippi is really one of the centers of transportation research around the world. We have a lot of unique facilities. We have our Hangar 2, which is a covered facility in which we build our model pavement sections. So we'll go in there and we'll build them from the ground up. So we do use our own construction teams. A lot of Vicksburg local engineers and technicians are involved in that research, doing that construction, building model pavements, trying new materials. And then we'll simulate the traffic using these heavy vehicle simulators. And as I mentioned earlier, the Titan has the ability for testing rail infrastructure too, because it has the load capacity. It can go up to 120,000 pounds now, and it can mount a rail bogie with four wheels on that rail bogie, so one end of a rail car, and simulate that load. So we're excited about that. We're excited about the opportunity that it brings to being able to conduct additional research and validation of new technologies using that device. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the most unique devices out there. And as and Jeremy will tell you a little bit about some of the other rail unique facilities that we have.
Yeah, so we had an existing test track at Erdc. It was 100 feet long, and we were using it basically for training opportunities. A couple of years ago, we had some congressional funding come in, and we took that opportunity to extend the test track out to 300 feet. Mm-hmm. In addition to using it for calibration, we did various subgrades and various soil type conditions. We even had buried a tree in the bottom of it to simulate some terrible track. and so anyway, what we're trying to do with that is to not only use it for incorporating new sensors and calibrating models for our sensors, we also want to, like I mentioned, we don't want to reinvent the wheel, but Jeb and his team have been using load carts for trafficking different various pavements. We want to do the same thing with rail. Mm-hmm. So we put in a couple of proposals to build a load cart specific to rail. Hopefully we'll get that awarded here within the next year or so, and work on having a way when the HVS is busy with pavement work, we'll have a way to get out and have an alternative way to test with loads. In addition to that, we have great relationships with our DOD partners at the installations. We currently have a 1,000-foot test section at McAllister Army Ammunition Plant in Oklahoma, where we're looking at the weather effects and loading effects of different crosstie materials. So we've got a section that's wood crossties, we've got several vendors from composite plastic crossties, and we've got a steel crosstie section. We've got that track instrumented up where if a train comes across, we're getting dynamic readings from that train with those various sensors, whether it be strain sensors or pressure sensors, to give us the effects of that train crossing different sections, across those different crossties, and things like that. As I mentioned, we always get questions on technical support from our installation. So if there's a certain question on how they should maintain their crossties or how they should replace their crossties, we're always providing technical support. The whole technology transfer that we talk about at Erdc, transferring our knowledge to the installation or the soldier or the industry, whoever that may be, we've really been trying to concentrate on getting what the answers that we're getting out to the public and out to the installations.
Right. Very important. Okay, so Erdc's STEM outreach program is reaching thousands of students across all grade levels each year. How did the program help each of you?
So as Jeremy mentioned, we really didn't see as much engagement in STEM when we were in high school. We had when I was in high school, we had an explorers group, but I didn't really know what that was. And I actually got involved with a different explorers group. I was actually in two. I was in the police one because that was just cool, you know, like go hang out with the police and see how they do. Everybody wants to carry a gun and arrest somebody, right? But then I was a member of the explorers group that looked at an engineering explorers group that went and looked at Grand Gulf. Mm-hmm. And so I went down and spent some time with some engineers there that really kind of fostered your idea. What is engineering? What do they do day to day? Is that something that I want to do as a young person? Mm-hmm. And leading that. But the real engagement came through at that time it was called Waterways Experiment Station, but we have a lot of student programs, a lot of internships. We have where students, even in high school, can come in to Erdc and work part-time, mm-hmm. or they can work over the summer and be an intern, and that exposure to engineering and the type of work we do can foster their, you know, their creativity and help them understand what engineers do and maybe lead them into a career in science and technology, engineering and math, STEM. And so since that time, ERDC has a lot of influences. As you know, my wife, Shelly Tingle, was very involved in our GEMS camps, mm-hmm. and which we have put on all these summer camps, and there's SAME camps. So there's a lot more engagement with young people across, I would say, 7th and 8th grade, all the way up through high school, that trying to grow interest in science and technology and engineering and math. And I think that there's a much more a better emphasis in that. And we try to foster that by, I think in our branch alone, we hire about 12 summer interns every year. And
that's great.
And it's a mixture. It's some that are, you know, sophomores, juniors, and seniors in high school, or rising sophomores and juniors and seniors, mm-hmm. which are very young. You know, those people are 16, 17, 18 years old. And then we have a lot of college students that come in that are, they're coming in for summer work or internship. And then we have some that are even come in as visiting professors and things like that. So there's a heavy mixture that we bring in, and that we try to get that interaction with young people to help guide them. And we'll ask them to do a small, short project. We ask them to give a little presentation so that it kind of shows the things that they've been exposed to for the summer. And if they come back a couple of summers, hopefully that'll be very meaningful to them in their personal development and their mm-hmm. career development. It also allows them to have solid internships on their resume. The job market isn't as competitive right now as it once was, because mm-hmm. there's jobs out there in engineering and scientists. Everywhere I look, everyone is hiring right now. So
right.
if you're an engineering student and you're coming out of college in the next year or two, you should have plenty of job opportunities. But sometimes there's not quite as much. And so in some fields, like aerospace engineering in particular, internships are critical. That's mm-hmm. what separates one student from another in a job application. And so having an internship from the U.S. Army Engineer Research and Development Center puts them in a better position to get the job that they want. They're going to have job offers from numerous agencies, but with those internships, they'll be able to choose the job that they want more than just taking a job that is offered to them.
Right.
So I'll let Jeremy talk about his STEM relationship. But I started actually at ERDC as a contract student. So I came through a student program back in 1991. I was actually...
Dating yourself.
Well, I just turned 50, so I'm already dating. But one of the cool things about that was I was going into nuclear engineering. As I mentioned, I was mm-hmm. in the Blue Explorer program. I went down and met the mechanical and nuclear engineers at Grand Gulf. And I was like, hey, this is cool. I didn't really know what was happening out at Waterway.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to work there over the summer as an 18-year-old in actually one of our hangars building these model pavement sections. And I had a great mentor, Mr. Steve Webster, mm-hmm. and another mentor, Dr. Al Bush, that spent time with me and then showed me what pavement engineers did. And it made such an impression on me that I changed to civil engineering before I ever went to college. So mm-hmm. at the end of the summer, before I started at Mississippi State, I switched from nuclear engineering into civil engineering.
It's good that you did that before you started.
Yeah, but it's not uncommon to switch during it.
Oh, yeah.
Most of your early years are prerequisites for any kind of engineering. But
right.
But their influence, and then I came back every summer, even during Christmas break, they would allow me to come and work for a couple of weeks, mm-hmm. make a little bit of spending money. And that experience really shaped me and really gave me that fire inside to do this kind of work. And I think that we offer that today. We provide a lot of young people from our community come to work with us, and all across ERDC. Like I said, our branch alone, which is one of 8 branches in GSL, hires about 12 interns every summer. And some of those work during the fall. I have one young man that's doing computer-aided drafting, mm-hmm. And he's from Warren Central, and he's doing that all throughout the year. So every afternoon, he'll come in and work a couple hours. So
okay.
it's a great opportunity to explore the STEM fields.
Awesome.
Yeah, like I said earlier, I really don't remember anyone coming from ERDC or anywhere else to talk about things during high school. The only thing that I remember from STEM was I had a physics teacher my senior year that called my dad right before graduation and was like, Jeremy needs to go into engineering. But I'd already made my mind up.
Oh, okay.
I was doing something else. So if I had somebody, you know, maybe tell me a little bit earlier, hey,
right.
if you want to go look at blast effects on different vehicles, you need to take algebra or calculus or physics,
right.
whatever it may be, kind of showing that end result. So one thing that I've tried to do here recently is that I've tried to engage, especially with St. Aloysius High School, because my wife, Christy Beasley, teaches there. Mm-hmm. She's a choral director. She teaches theology and environmental science. So with the environmental science, I've tried to get her to get her class involved. And recently, last week, they just went on their first field trip to Erdick.
Fantastic.
So made a connection there. And then I was helping build the set for their musical this spring, or this spring. Mm-hmm. And got the opportunity to talk to a couple of seniors, and we're, of course, picking their brains on what are you going to be when you grow up? What do you want to do? And some of them were saying, I want to go into business, and I was trying to emphasize that, you know, business is fine, but you need to have a niche, you know, to stand out above the crowd. Mm-hmm. Well, I found one that was interested in engineering, and he was interested in staying in Vicksburg. Well, I went to my branch chief, found out about all the opportunities for prospective students. Mm-hmm. He enrolled in the AEOP program. Got accepted, so we're going to have our first AEOP for the railroad team this summer.
Look at you making that difference.
Right.
That's awesome.
So if we can, my goal is I'd like to start with St. Aloysius because I'm familiar with there. I have it in there. But just get out and talk to, you know, the students of, you know, what's going on at Erdick. These are the things you can do. You can stay in Vicksburg and do some really, really cool things.
Absolutely.
You know, groundbreaking things. So trying to get out and tell them ahead of time, not the last semester of, you know, high school. Just trying to build that relationship and break down the barrier between Erdick and, you know, the community.
Absolutely.
And I don't think the community really understands what Erdick is or what opportunities it has out there. Mm-hmm. When you talk to others in the community that don't have relatives that work there, that understand what's going on and the types of world-class research that's going on, things like this podcast, mm-hmm. and our outreach programs that we've developed over, I want to say it's really been an emphasis the last 10 years, probably, yeah, more so. It's rapidly expanding that awareness of, mm-hmm. of what's out there and what the opportunities are. And we're seeing the impact of that. So I think these podcasts, the GEMS camps, the SAME, which is Society of American Military Engineer Camp, mm-hmm. these summer camps for young people, they're spreading the word, and
right.
we're getting our engineers and scientists out there in science fairs and things at all the schools, and trying to have that influence. And I think it's more prevalent now than it was in our time. I think from both of our experiences, we're trying to be a part of that and engage in that across our spheres of influence within the community.
Yeah. And it's much appreciated.
Yeah, I think whether you know what you want to be when you grow up or not, there's an opportunity at Erdick, right? So, I mean, if you don't have a degree, there's opportunities. If you have an associate degree, there's opportunities. If you have a undergrad, master's, or a doctorate, there's all kinds of opportunities out there. Mm-hmm. You just got to, you know, it's one of those type things like Vicksburg. You've got to get involved and ask the right people questions. But we're, like Jeff said, we're trying to be proactive on that front and get out and speak ahead of it instead
right.
of people coming to us and asking us questions.
Absolutely. Well, we're fixing to wrap up here with our last question. This is going to be a deep question. What do you want listeners to remember from this valuable conversation?
I think that what I'd like for the listeners to remember is that that science and engineering makes a difference. That our ability to go out there and discover something that is not being used now, to apply that to a problem that we need to solve, mm-hmm. To take that solution and then distribute that to users, it makes a difference in the world. Mm-hmm. So even though that Jeremy and I's research happens to be mostly focused on the military side, that a lot of the technologies we developed are readily available to be used by civil infrastructure for your roads, your I-20, your county roads, mm-hmm. All these different places. And that if you want to make a difference, then Erdick is a great place to come and do that. Erdick. You know, there are jobs and there are careers. And I think about Erdick as being a career. So when you enter into employment with the Erdick, you should have a career mindset. And that's what we look for when we're recruiting people. We want somebody that's not just looking for a job.
Right.
We let them look for a career, because the biggest thing out of it is, yes, you can make a living. Yes, you can be successful from a financial standpoint, and you can have good benefits and things. But the main thing is that reward is what's going to fulfill you. Sooner or later in life, you come to a point and there needs to be more than just going to work every day just mm-hmm. for a paycheck. That you got to have that reward. And working at Erdick, serving the nation, serving your country, seeing how it makes a difference, mm-hmm. That's very impactful. That's very fulfilling on our side. So I want to kind of leave the community with that. Erdick is a great place to work. It's been voted as one of the best places to work in the DOD Department of Defense for many years in a row. And I've worked there for 31 years as a contractor and then as an employee. And it, and I can honestly say that I've enjoyed most of that time. Like, and you never in a career, you're never going to have every, right. every day is not going to be perfect. You're right. going to have some bad days. But overall, it's been a super rewarding experience. And for a local person, I think it provides a tremendous opportunity for young people and in the community to explore their dreams.
Awesome.
Yeah, I would just like to encourage anyone listening that whether they work at ERDC or any other STEM-related area to, you know, get involved with your local schools, take the opportunity to get out and tell your story, how you ended up where you are, because whether or not you think they are interested or not, they are interested. They want to hear, you know, what the whys and the whats and all those type of things. So get out and take the opportunity. I'm sure that your leadership will be behind you, get, you know, taking a 15-minute break, 30-minute break to go and speak to some students. So I encourage anybody that can, especially those that are in Vicksburg, that are able to get out, that work at ERDC, to get out, get involved with your local schools, and speak to what's going on at ERDC.
Fantastic. Well, thank you guys so much for being on the show today.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
And I hope maybe you guys can come back and talk some more, maybe in some future episodes.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for listening to Beyond the Gates, How ERDC Makes the Difference. And we will come back at you next week. Have a great day.